Welcome to the Australian Catholic Historical Society podcast. At the Society's October 2022 meeting, Professor John Potts, Professor of Media in the Department of Media, Communications, Creative Arts, Language and Literature, Macquarie University, spoke about religion on ABC radio in the 1940s and 50s. His 20 slides accompany this talk at the ACHS website. If you're viewing the slides while listening, start at the title page when you first hear this sound. Each time it's repeated, this will be our cue to advance to the next slide. In welcoming Professor Potts, the Society's president, Dr. John Carmody, said this.
John grew up in Cessnock, had his undergraduate education at the University of Newcastle, PhD at UTS, and is now professor of more things than I can care to name, but head of this, most relevantly, I think, the Centre for Media History at Macquarie University. And that's a very important initiative which Macquarie University has been pursuing, and there are a number of books and publications come out of that about the history of the media, the often unrecognised history and influence of the media in Australia. And John has researched and published in that field, and he's also written a book on the history of charisma, history of religious charisma. So he's a man of many parts. So with that, with no further announcements or fuss, I'll ask John to address us on history of religious broadcasts on the ABC in Australia, a very, very important part of the activities of the ABC, as we will no doubt learn as the session goes on. Thanks very much, John.
Thank you, Jack, and thanks for all coming along today. The title of my talk there is a bit of a misnomer, because there's no way in the short amount of time I've got today that I can cover from the 1940s to the present. But what I am going to do is look at the most important part of that, which is 1940s and 1950s, because, as I'll go on to say, it's when the ABC dealt with the sectarian issue in society, in Australian society, which was extremely significant at the time and will probably be of interest to members of Catholic Historical Society as well. Now, this is part of an ongoing project on the history of ABC Radio National that is part of a project within the Centre for Media History at Macquarie. It was also an ARC discovery grant project, and the people working on it are Professor Bridget Griffin Foley, that many of you may know, and Dr. Virginia Madsen, who was formerly a producer at the ABC for many years. And this will ultimately result in a book on the history of ABC radio and already many journal articles and essays. So my part of that project was to look at religion on ABC radio, and what I'm talking about today is part of that. It has been published as a journal article, so if anyone is interested, please get hold of me via Jack, perhaps, and I can send you the published version of what I'm talking about today. So the focus of this talk is on the ecumenical nature of religious broadcasting on ABC National Radio in the 40s and 50s. My specific concern is with the ways which the ABC contributed to a national conversation on religion and culture in those decades. The important factor in this national conversation is the sectarianism within Christianity, which was a prominent social factor in Australian life of this period. The ABC made a concerted effort in the 40s and 50s to override the sectarianism dividing the Christian community. ABC National Radio led the cultural conversion on religious tolerance, deliberately avoiding sectarian conflict at a time when Protestant Catholic antipathy was a significant aspect of Australian life. The role of the ABC in influencing cultural life in Australia has been little examined. Alison Healy, whom I believe is a member of this society, in her PhD thesis, which was a study of ABC religious broadcasting from 1941 to 1991, asserts that the contribution of ABC religious broadcasting to reconciliation in Australia has yet to be fully told and assessed. This presentation details the ABC's contribution to a non-sectarian religious discourse, assessing it as a significant contribution to ecumenical reconciliation. The ABC, as many of you will be familiar with, was founded in 1932 as the Australian National Broadcaster, very much modelled on the BBC, which was founded in 1922. The Australian Broadcasting Commission Act of 1931 stipulated that the ABC was to take in the interests of the community in broadcasting comprehensive programs. The ABC's first chairman, Charles Lloyd-Jones, noted with approval that the ABC, like its British relative, set out with the mission to enlighten the nation. My colleague Virginia Madsen, who's done a lot of work on the BBC and the ABC, has described public broadcasting of this type as cultural radio, with a mission to inform, educate and entertain. Paddy Scannell, another theorist of the history of radio, has described the cultural radio practiced by the BBC as possessing a core commitment to the universal dissemination of the radio service as an inclusive public good. The ABC sought to emulate this mission of cultural radio as exerting an inclusive public good on a national basis. Now, a national network of ABC radio stations was running from 1939, and religious programming was a small but significant component of ABC broadcasting from the beginning. In 1946, ABC output was formally consolidated into a national program network and an interstate network. In his history of the ABC, Ken Inglis notes that in adopting this structure, the ABC followed BBC policy of offering listeners a range of programs. The national service was considered more serious or loftier in its programming. From 1932, Australian Broadcasting operated a dual system of the national broadcast in the ABC and commercial radio. The commercial stations attracted more listeners in the 1940s and 50s than did the ABC, although regional listeners in country towns relied heavily on ABC radio. The ABC could thereby claim to be the national broadcaster due to its national network of stations reaching regional and country centres. In the 1940s, religious programming on the ABC was coordinated by the Controller of Talks, but from 1943 was effectively run by Reverend Kenneth Henderson, described by Inglis as a one-man department of religious broadcasting. In 1949, this one-man department was promoted to head of his own department as religion was removed from the orbit of Talks and given its own administrative control within the ABC. Henderson remained head of this department until 1956, so much of my attention today is on the form of religious broadcasting on the ABC developed under Henderson's oversight. Australia's often been regarded as a secular nation, but the 1901 census in the year of Federation revealed only a tiny percentage, 1.7%, claiming no religion or making no reply. In a general population which was 98% British, in origin, the religious affiliation of Australians completing the census, and Aborigines, of course, were not included at this time, followed British alignments. The critical sectarianism prevalent in Australian society also took its cue from Britain. Now, in these figures, which go from 1901 all the way up to 2006, the maroon on the bottom is Anglican, the yellow next up is Catholic, and you can see the shifting proportion. Others are either other Christian or other religions. The Christian sectarianism prevalent in Australian society also took its cue from Britain. The Catholic minority, which in 1901 accounted for 23% of the population, largely comprised Irish immigrants, many from working class backgrounds. The Protestant majority, which comprising Anglican, 40% in the 1901 census, and other denominations, a further 34%, they're in blue, aligned itself with governing institutions, the monarchy and empire. This social pattern changed little over succeeding decades. The 1947 census, that's also there, revealed that 39% of the population nominated as Anglican and 21% as Catholic. Other Christian, which was mainly Protestant, accounted for 28%. Non-Christian religion was only 0.5% of census respondents, while no religion and no reply accounted for 11%. The 1954 census figures were barely changed, 38% Anglican, 23% Catholic, no religion, 10%. This pattern in religious affiliation remained stable until the 1960s. In the first half of the 20th century, however, religious life in Australia was largely shaped by an often bitter opposition between Protestants and Catholics. This antagonism was a marked social factor from the beginning of European settlement. The Protestant majority exerted social dominance from the foundation of the colony. Catholics were denied the ministry of priests in New South Wales until 1803. Even then, this ministry was withdrawn after 1 year following an Irish uprising, which affirmed suspicions within the Protestant colonial ruling class of Irish Catholic sedition. The mutual hostility between Protestants and Catholics remained virulent throughout the 19th century and well into the 20th. Manning Clark records a sectarian bitterness expressed in the taunts of schoolchildren: "Protestant, Protestant, ring the bell. Catholic, Catholic, go to hell." From the Protestant perspective, Catholicism was regarded as foreign, which that meant based at Rome, treasonous, corrupt, superstitious, and untrustworthy. Conflict between rival religious leaders in Australia frequently emerged at major public events, such as the celebrations to mark the centenary of settlement in 1888. Both the Catholic Archbishop and Anglican Bishop demanded the honour of leading the public in prayer. When this dispute could not be resolved, a politician was asked to lead the public prayer. The jostling between religious leaders repeated itself at the procession celebrating Federation in 1901. This time, the Anglican primate, described by Manning Clark as a fine representative of the Protestant ascendancy, took precedence in leading prayer. The Catholic Archbishop, affronted at being offered second place, boycotted the procession, instead leading an alternative celebration outside St Mary's. This competition for public recognition continued at least until 1953, and we'll see on the next slide a cartoon from 1953, when on this occasion the Catholic Archbishop was given precedence at the coronation of Elizabeth II, much to the chagrin of the Anglican primate, who's here left on the footpath watching the taxi go past with Robert Menzies. Mutual antagonism was much more severe during the conscription debates of 1916-17. The trade unions and Irish Catholics opposing conscription were virulently denounced as traitors by the Protestant forces upholding Australia's alignment with monarchy and empire. Humphrey McQueen notes that at the height of conscription bitterness, an advertisement for parlour maids at Government House in Victoria stipulated that only Protestants need apply. In 1919, Catholic nuns were refused permission to staff an emergency hospital set up during the influenza epidemic, as if their touch represented another form of contamination. As the Depression took hold in 1930, the combined choirs of the churches of Brunswick performed concerts to raise money for distressed citizens. Manning Clark observes that these choirs were Protestant only, because not even the Depression transcended sectarianism in Australia. In his study of Australian sectarianism from 1945, Benjamin Edwards notes that sectarian discord was more than squabbles among religious leaders. Sectarianism in 20th century Australia was pertinent to issues of national identity. Edwards asserts that sectarianism has long been a significant factor in Australian history, with implications for political, religious, and social cultures, and in the private sphere where some of the bitterest sectarian disputes arose. The hatred and suspicion flowing both ways between Protestants and Catholics was perpetuated by the school system. Donald Horne notes that fear and hatred of Rome led secularists and Protestants to combine to secularise the state and education in the late 19th century. The colonies legislated for free, compulsory and secular education by 1895. This, in effect, meant that state schools were for the children of Protestants. The Catholic Church funded a network of schools for the children of Catholics. One consequence of this division was that Catholics and Protestants did not meet socially, allowing mutual hatreds to be fed by ignorance of each other. Particularly in country areas where sectarianism was often more intense and longer lasting than in the cities, the separation of schools not only entrenched ignorance and mistrust, but represented a wasteful spread of educational resources. Towns which were barely able to support one school had to support two. State aid for Catholic schools finally commenced after the 1962 protest closure of the Goulburn Catholic School. And the next slide, I think, has press coverage of that. The distress caused by sectarian conflict may be best described at the interpersonal level. Mixed marriage was a particularly painful subject, as the Catholic Church recognised marriage and subsequent children only if sanctioned by the Church. Similarly, it was an excommunicable offence until the late 1960s for a Catholic to attend a non-Catholic church. This had the regrettable consequence that close friends and even relatives were forbidden to attend weddings, funerals and rites of passage. It was common as late as the late 1960s for Catholic guests to wait outside a Protestant church during a wedding or funeral. Sectarianism began to fade along with professed religious faith in the 1960s, but as late as 1964, Donald Horne could write, "Bitter distrust of the Catholic Church is part of the system of beliefs of most older non-Catholic Australians." In his Boyer Lectures of 1988, the Australian novelist David Malouf asserted that in the period prior to the 1960s, the strongest of all divisions in Australian society was the sectarian one. Malouf noted that Catholics and Protestants attended different schools and learnt different versions of history. Because the Catholics in Australia were almost exclusively of Irish origin, the sectarian division had an ethnic and historical element. The Australian divide reproduced the Irish resistance to English oppression on one side and the English fear of Irish subversion on the other. For Malouf, the sectarian division functioned institutionally as well as at street level. Catholics worked in certain areas of the public service, Protestants in others. In Queensland, the Labor Party was predominantly Catholic, while Protestants were mainly liberals. Malouf provides a vivid description of life in Brisbane in the early 1940s, when Catholic and Protestant Australians lived separate lives. The division between them, the separation, the hostility, was part of the very fabric of living, so essential to life here, so old and deeply rooted, as to seem immemorial and impossible to change. So, how did the ABC construct its religious broadcasting, and how did its religion department engage with such a deep sectarian problem? Religion had been a component of ABC broadcasting since 1932. Indeed, in the early years, our broadcast church services took up more time than radio plays. The ABC differed from its BBC model in that it was not bound to the Anglican Church by law as the national faith. Instead, the ABC allocated airtime to religions and dominations on the basis of the most recent census showing religious adherence. This meant in the 1940s that religion was understood as denominational Christianity, Anglican, Catholic and other Protestant. The exception to this denominational rule on the ABC was three broadcasts per year for Jewish festivals. Ecumenical religious broadcasting therefore meant, for the ABC, a balance between Christian denominations without favouring Catholic or Protestant expressions of the faith. The national census figures of 1947 and 1954 indeed recognised only Hebrew religion as a specifically non-Christian faith, and then only around 0.5%. While other religions and dominations were grouped together as a miscellaneous category of about 2%. The ABC was scrupulous in its allocation of airtime depending on the census, whose statistics were applied with mathematical precision to determine whose church services broadcast. This statistical method offered some protection to the ABC against charges of partiality in the allocation of airtime. An example of the census method, the Church of England, which claimed 46.583%, they really did go to three decimal points, of religious adherence, this is in the 1933 census, was allocated 25.503 services, rounded down to 25. That meant they were allowed 25 nationally broadcast services from a total of 52. That's how it was worked out statistically. This obsession with percentages and statistics, including decimal points, is found also in the ABC annual reports, which calculated the precise percentage of airtime for religious broadcasting. This is 1939 to 40. I don't know if you can see it clearly. 3.38% was religious broadcasting, and the next one shows 1947 to 1948 still at 3.08%. So I think statisticians were short of a job in the ABC at this point. The meticulous apportioning of airtime based on a transparent method drawn from the most recent census was one way in which the ABC negotiated the sectarian minefield. It could not be accused of Protestant or Catholic bias if it could point to the strict correspondence between airtime and census. The same principle applied to all denominations. The Protestant denominations other than the Church of England were allocated airtime strictly based on the number of adherents. And we have that in the next one. In 1947, for example, the Methodist Church, with 12.781% of the population according to the 1941 census, was granted 7 national services from a total of 52, but the Congregational Church, with only 0.825% of 1%, was offered none. The more important means of engaging with sectarianism, however, was in the types of religious broadcasting programs broadcast in the 1940s and 50s. Under Henderson and the ABC chairman Richard Boyer, the official ABC policy was to avoid the broadcasting of sectarian religion altogether. Boyer noted in 1944 that the commission had bitter experiences of the division of the Christian churches when doctrine was expounded on air. The ABC policy, as revealed in a paper for a Commonwealth Broadcasting Conference in 1952, was that controversy as between Christian denominations is simply not permitted. Our broadcasters must not attack or refer provocatively to the views of other religious bodies. Denominational viewpoints are not obtruded except where they are asked for. More positively, Henderson aimed to communicate with as many Australians as possible through broadcasting. Dogmatic differences could only be an impediment to this goal. Henderson's vision of Christianity was ecumenical and resolutely non-sectarian. He was, in fact, an Anglican priest, formerly a wartime chaplain, who'd also worked as a journalist. He had a liberal, progressive approach to faith, shaped by 2 formative years at Oxford, where he was exposed to modernist ideas in theology. His views were also influenced by his experience in World War II. Henderson was, it seemed, too progressive for the Anglican Church in Australia, which offered him no preferment. His path instead was to make the ABC a valuable avenue for the church and to use the radio medium to reach a wider audience than reached by the churches. In Boyer, who was chairman from 1945, he had a strong supporter. The 2 men had similar backgrounds. Boyer, too, had been a wartime chaplain and a similar religious outlook, summarised by Inglis as broad, undogmatic, seeking commitment across sectarian boundaries as a vision of Christianity as agent of civilization. Boyer wrote in 1949 that our own ambition for the National Radio Service is its purposive use for the appreciation of the spiritual values of Christianity. Henderson's vision for religious broadcasting can best be discerned in the program called Plain Christianity, A Word to the Wayfarer. This program, devised by Henderson and Boyer, commenced in 1947 on Sunday nights at 7:30, targeting a broad audience. Henderson persuaded the rival church leaders to accept it as a replacement for actual broadcasts of worship on Sunday evenings. No doubt Henderson considered this new studio service an improvement on yet another broadcast from the pulpit, one more likely to reach cross-denominational audiences. Speakers on this program were instructed not to articulate denominational differences, not to speak as if preaching to their own congregation. Speakers were in fact told to imagine that they were addressing 6 listeners who shared none of their assumptions and to commend their faith as best they can. If you can put on the next slide, it actually shows a transcript of one of the programs of Plain Christianity, which this one was published in ABC publication, as were several others. This was a talk by the British Reverend Eric Loveday on Plain Christianity from 1947. Henderson's ambition with this program was to reach non-churchgoers, the kind of people he'd met during the war. These were the multitude of wayfarers who, he wrote in 1947, could best be served by a message of companionship addressed directly to them that bears immediately and obviously on the daily life. Readings addressed to these wayfarers should mean something for the day's work. The intended audience for Plain Christianity, which included non-churchgoers, dictated the tone of the program, a plain ecumenical message unencumbered by sectarian distinctions. Other religious programs broadcast in this period were crafted by Henderson's policy of radio in the service of religion. The 9:30 a.m. Sunday program was known as a radio service. Its content was denominational, but it incorporated, at Henderson's urging, radio forms including discussion, drama and documentary. A Monday morning program called Facing the Week was intended for the non-church-going wayfarers not bound by denominational affiliation. Music was used in a number of programs to increase the appeal to listeners from a non-church background. From 1950, a program called Prelude accompanied plain Christianity. Prelude featured traditional and modern sacred music sung by a small group of singers. From 1948, the Sunday evening schedule included community hymn singing. Henderson approved of this musical program's homely atmosphere. Indeed, he resisted attempts to replace congregations with more professional and tuneful choirs. The plain, imperfect singing offered by the congregations was, for Henderson, part of this program's appeal. The program Daily Devotional, which ran from Monday to Saturday at 10 a.m., had a broad-based approach similar to plain Christianity. Described in an internal ABC memo as strictly undenominational, Daily Devotional targeted women at home, invalids and the elderly. The Saturday version of the program was directed at working men. Henderson briefed broadcasters on this program to speak as though to a single listener, offering one new clear insight into the life he or she is living. The unified ecumenical religious approach was also featured on the program Epilogue, retitled Evening Meditation in 1947, which was broadcast on the national network at the close of service. The Sunday 11 a.m. broadcast from a church service remained denominational, but Henderson frequently expressed disappointment in the church's lackluster performance in their communication. The programs devised and overseen by Henderson seemed to have operated at a different register to the broadcast church services. This difference is reflected in a report written by the ABC Director of Programs in 1954. Services broadcast from churches seem to have made little forward movement over the years. Religious talks, however, seem to be planned always with an eye to presenting non-sectarian Christianity in an extraordinarily effective way. In his book Media and Religion, Daniel Stout notes that the ambivalent engagement religion is often made with media. Stout proposes that this ambivalence derives in part from a Christian paradox, in which the world should be embraced for its beauty, knowledge, and opportunities for experience, but simultaneously rejected for its evil aspects. Both Catholic and Protestant denominations have approached broadcast media with an ambivalent attitude. They've embraced the media, including radio, as catalysts for religious learning, while at the same time exercising awareness concerning secular media, which may broadcast material offensive to religious sensibilities. The Christian churches involved in ABC radio broadcasting in the 1940s and 50s often sought a direct broadcast of their church services. Radio in this regard was construed by the churches as a neutral medium, a vessel through which to communicate the conventional form of worship. Each denomination was able to control form and content of their broadcasts, such as the Sunday 11 a.m. church service. This conservative deployment of radio medium was anathema to Henderson, however, who decried the poor results when a microphone simply transmitted the contents of a church service. For Henderson, the churches were failing to engage listeners when their religious messages were transmitted in such unimaginative ways. Henderson urged Christian leaders instead to construct religious broadcasting using the qualities of the radio medium. One result of this was the Plain Christianity program, which Henderson convinced the church leaders to put on instead of their own services. In 1953, Henderson told a meeting of the Federal Religious Advisory Committee in Sydney, that broadcasting could be an ally of the churches. Henderson conceived of religious broadcasting as something more than putting a mic in a pulpit. His mission in radio was to experiment with the forms of the medium. He believed in the virtues of the radio service, communicating to a person at home, performing an act of worship like sitting in a pew. As Boyer remarked, we all have a direct link to God. And for Henderson and Boyer, radio was part of that line. This approach could perhaps be considered Protestant in its theology, The radio service was conceived as an extension through the medium of radio to the church service, in which the line to God passes through the priest, without other intermediaries and enhanced tradition of Catholicism. But the intention and effect was ecumenical, as reflected in the programmes overseen by Henderson. In an effort to improve the church's broadcast efforts, the ABC in fact published in 1947 1,000 copies of a booklet called Broadcasting as a Religious Opportunity, written by Henderson to advise church broadcasters. Foremost in his advice was the difference between pulpit and radio, whereby broadcasting makes greater demands on sensitivity of the voice. It's by intimacy, Henderson wrote, that you must do your evangelising. Henderson displays in Broadcasting as a Religious Opportunity an understanding of the properties of radio as a medium. This is what he wishes to impart to religious broadcasters. It's readily apparent, he remarks, that broadcasting ministers must get a grasp of new conditions when their work is being done outside the environment of the church. Simply transferring a sermon to radio wouldn't do, he said. On the air, the listener must be talked with, not at. It's not shouldn't be second-hand lecturing, it's not crowd preaching. Conventional sermonising into the mic will only succeed in alienating the audience. The first principle of broadcasting, he said, is not to bore the listeners. The speaker must engage with the listeners, using the microphone to show they are really caring for the listeners and moved by what he is saying. Sincerity in a speaker is something readily detected by radio listeners, Henderson professes, as is its opposite, artificial, pompous, or insincere preaching. The artificial utterance called Parson's voice is a fault guaranteed to lose a broadcaster all his audience at once. Henderson is candid in his view that the churches have produced many Parson's voices but very few good broadcasters. No denomination in any state, he says, has more than 5 or 6 outstanding broadcasters. The ABC, he notes, asks church heads and committees to provide broadcasters whose voice and on-air personality could be considered outstanding broadcasting gifts. He's advocating greater quality control when he recommends that a bishop should tell an archdeacon, "My dear fellow, the Lord has given you every gift but that of broadcasting." Such candour is necessary, Henderson claims, is if the church is not to let itself down on air. In a section entitled What the Air Can Do, Henderson states that radio is infinitely the greatest and most varied opportunity that organised Christianity has ever had. The great advantage of radio for Henderson is its ability to reach masses of non-churchgoers. He explains that the ABC chose broadcasters, lay and clerical, for his specially designed Sunday night programmes. The challenge for those broadcasters is to think themselves into the mind and problems of the wayfaring man. Plain Christianity is meant to help those who have no fixed place of abode in their religious life. The programme would not work, Henderson says, if inflicted with sermonising, parson's voice or sectarian dogma. Instead, it was founded on a message of companionship addressed directly to the non-church attending listener. This was a specifically new kind of religious broadcasting advocated by Henderson. The ABC's annual report for 1947 articulated Henderson's vision of reaching beyond established religious communities to a larger and less well-defined body of listeners, who may not be bound to any established form of religion, but are interested in fundamental questions of life. The report noted that plain Christianity was intended for this larger group of listeners who, as non-churchgoers, had no interest in denominational or sectarian concerns. Great care was taken to achieve a broadcast of high standard that would have a practical and personal appeal to as many listeners as possible. The ecumenical tenor of ABC religious radio in this period may be contrasted with the religious programmes broadcast on Australian commercial radio in the same period. There was no governing ecumenical policy for commercial radio. Certain commercial stations broadcast either staunchly Catholic or Protestant programming. As a result, there had long been sectarian rivalry on Australia's commercial airways, as Bridget Griffin Foley observes in Changing Stations, her History of Australian Commercial Radio. Religious organisations were involved in the foundation of some of the earliest Australian radio stations, the Theosophical Society and 2GB in 1926, the Catholic Church and 2SM in 1931. The Catholic Church had earlier bought airtime on 2UE in 1928 when Father James Meaney broadcast the International Eucharistic Congress from Sydney, a congress denounced by Protestant groups as worship of the wafer. The success of this broadcast encouraged the foundation of the Catholic Broadcasting Company, which was awarded the licence of 2SM, named after St Mark's, Meaney's parish in Des Moines. As managing director of the station, Meaney incorporated Catholic news, doctrine and history into station programming. Dr Rumble's Question Box, a Sunday night program hosted by Reverend Dr Leslie Rumble, explored Catholic issues in a popular show that ran from 1931 until 1968. Protestants advocated their own version of Christianity on other commercial stations. The Anglican Reverend T.C. Hammond broadcast on Sydney station 2CH. His assertive style of broadcasting included attacks on Catholicism in such radio talks as Blunders of the Pope, which is very blunt, and this is an example of typical anti-Catholic propaganda from the Protestant side, associating the Catholic Church with superstition, tyranny with only one end, Romanism, ignorance, corruption. Hammond's substantial Protestant listenership emboldened 2CH management to pit his program against Rumble's Catholic 2SM session. Another 2CH program, What Protestants Think, commenced in 1952, featuring evangelical leaders, while a collection of Hammond's talks was transcribed and published as The Case for Protestantism. A Presbyterian Reverend Dr. George Tulloch broadcast sectarian lectures in Perth with titles such as The Church of Rome and Persecution. Griffin Foley records that the adversarial approach to religious broadcasting on commercial radio attracted criticism from listeners. The Australian Broadcasting Control Board was told by one listener in 1952 that she was fed up by different denominations turning religious broadcasting into competition for who can howl the others down. The volume of overt sectarian programming diminished in the 1950s. Meaney's death in 1953 prompted a change of management structure at 2SM. This Catholic Sydney station was henceforth under secular managers, while religious programming was overseen by Catholic priests in board positions. But sectarian religious broadcasts remained prominent on commercial radio into the 1960s. The Christian Broadcasting Association, founded in 1953, distributed religious broadcasts on a national basis. By 1966, the CBA provided 500 religious programs to 83 commercial Australian stations. This association had no Catholic members. A parallel organisation called the National Catholic Radio and Television Centre was formed in 1962. The rival Protestant and Catholic broadcast organisations produced and distributed sectarian material around the nation. Protestant and Catholics remained wary of each other's impact through broadcasting. The Anglican Reverend Bernard Judd, who broadcast vociferous commentaries on 2CH, urged the CBA as late as 1972 to produce more material, thereby eliminating airspace for Marxist and Roman items. At the ABC, Henderson made strenuous ecumenical efforts behind the scenes. As early as 1942, he organised meetings with Anglican, Catholic and non-Episcopal clergy to urge their collaboration in broadcasting. These efforts were not immediately successful. For over a decade, there were plans for two committees, a separate one for Catholics. But by 1953, Henderson was able to form the Federal Religious Advisory Committee, or FRAC, a cross-denominational group on religious broadcasting that lasted until 1976. Criticisms of the broad-based ecumenical nature of ABC programs largely came from the Catholic Church. In 1952, a Catholic spokesman pejoratively described the generalist ABC approach as watered-down religion presented on the air. The determination by the ABC to avoid sectarian controversy attracted the criticism that the resulting programs were rather bland. Another Catholic reverend complained to the FRAC in 1954 the programs were rather too nebulous and that impartially regulated controversy might be an improvement. The ABC, however, remained resolute in its non-sectarian approach. The ABC's policy of inclusiveness in religious broadcasting pursued a vision of cultural radio, whose commitment was to an inclusive public good. Scannell argues that public broadcasting's reasons and justifications are ultimately ethical. These motivations behind cultural radio are concerned with what we think a good society should be like. They're underpinned by a commitment to common goods. The ABC's ecumenical policy concerning religious broadcasting was driven by a similarly inclusive approach, a commitment to common goods. Ecumenical rather than sectarian radio was the path taken to achieve this goal. There were limits to this ecumenical policy. The Greek Orthodox Church complained of its exclusion, which was justified by the ABC on language ground. Small sects were also included from airplay. By late 1960s, however, the range of religious beliefs given airtime broadened considerably, in part a reflection of changing demographics in Australian society. And you can see that reflected in these census figures. At one stage, Anglican denomination ceases to be the majority faith, is overtaken by Catholic, and other denominations are particularly Orthodox. Immigration from the 1950s brought with it an increase in the Catholic population, as well as other Christian beliefs such as Orthodox. Census from the 1960s show a decline in Anglican affiliations, an increase in Catholic, and increases in other religions and in no religion. The 1971 census disclosed a reduction in Anglican affiliation to 31%, an increase in Catholics to 27%, other Christian at 28%, and no religion at 13%. By 1986, Anglicans at 24% no longer outnumbered Catholics at 26%, and the percentage of the population nominating no religion or informal had markedly increased to 25%. Religion in the 1970s, as now, incorporated spiritual practices, non-Christian faiths and sects, including Indian religion and myriad mystical pursuits and practices such as meditation, which at the time were labelled New Age religion. The national conversation on religion, spirituality, faith or non-faith became more complex. This inclusivity was conveyed in religious programming on the ABC, which then and now incorporated the wide range of religious, spiritual and mystical pursuits practising contemporary society. The contribution to the ABC was no less significant in the 1940s and 50s, however, at a time when religion in Australia was much narrower and basically meant Protestant or Catholic. The corrosive antagonism between these two faiths, sustained by prejudice and mistrust, was a serious social issue, which the ABC Religion Department sought to alleviate. Its intervention in this area through sustained religious broadcasting can be regarded as a significant voice in the national conversation of the time. Thank you.
Dr. John Carmody moderated the Q&A.
Thank you very much, John. I'm sure there's great scope for question, comment and reflection in that. Mary.
Thank you very much for your interesting talk. In 1953... I knew two people who worked for the ABC. They later married. The man became a Catholic before the marriage, and he spoke on the ABC. Now, he did not use the term Roman Catholic, and the ABC complained that it was... That was not their policy. He should have said Roman Catholic. The priest who was instructing him to become a Catholic called him a proper little bigot. I just wondered if you would like to comment on that.
I did see that. I was looking back through all the research notes and I did see a document, or maybe it was in one of the ABC annual reports or somewhere else, about that very thing, about the policy that Catholic was meant to have the nomination Roman Catholic. I didn't really understand the significance of it at the time, but are you saying that would have been offensive to Catholics at the time?
Perhaps, and I was just thinking that I'm a Dominican and a member of my own order in England. I think it was Vincent McNabb. Not quite sure, but he was extremely keen on being called a Roman Catholic. So I just wondered if you'd like to comment.
Oh, yeah, it's true. I did see a document from around that time that it was the ABC official policy to use the term Roman Catholic. But I'm not really aware of the broader significance of that. Perhaps some of the members of the society are.
No, thanks very much. My name's Patrick Kirkwood. I joined the ABC religious department in 1961. So just after the Henderson era. But I won't talk about that now. On the business about Roman Catholic, there's an edginess because there's a branch of the Anglican Church that says it's Catholic. There are other churches that use the word Catholic. They're all part of the Catholic Church. And so, out of a sense of nicety to them, the policy was to call Catholics who subscribe to the Pope as Roman Catholics.
Right.
But as the years went on, that got a very blurred distinction, and if somebody said Catholic, we didn't really worry.
Right.
I would love to congratulate you on your speech. I thought it was absolutely excellent. It was a walk down memory lane for me because I was in the ABC from 1961 till the end of 1985. And we built on what Kenneth Henderson did at the beginning, and I had the pleasure of knowing him in 1961-62. I was working in Melbourne, and he occasionally would come in to do a talk for us about some particular topic. He was an extraordinary gentleman. And the man that followed him, Dr. John Munro, was also an extraordinarily gifted man. That's all I'll say for the present, but I thought your presentation was spot on.
Well, thank you, and apologies that I only went up to 1956, which was the end of the Henderson era. But look, I would like to speak to you later because I am obligated to go on past 1956 for this book as part of the Centre for Mr. Heath Media History Research Project. So there's a lot more for me to cover. Yeah. So I'd like to talk to you, maybe speak to you later in that regard.
All I can say now is that what we did in subsequent years was building on that ecumenical dimension. I mean, luckily, the seminary where I originally studied, the seminaries in those days used to talk about the them and us, basically. When we did the section on the church, quotes, the documents we had were from the World Council of Churches. And so each church, as it was described, was in their own words and not ours. So I was very lucky to have that background. So when I got into the ABC, ecumenism kind of fitted us like a glove.
Good. Okay, wonderful.
Thank you very much for the presentation. I kind of noticed a small shift in what you said, in that you seemed to be talking about the importance that was ascribed to the percentages and so on.
Yes.
And but then later on you described the message as being a message of companionship. And I wondered whether you saw that as a bit of a shift, that you didn't necessarily sort of press forward in your presentation?
Well, I think the initial strategy was to go by the statistics, the census statistics, to so that the ABC could protect itself from, you know, sectarian bias either way. But I don't think that's what Henderson's philosophy was about. I think he wanted to override that whole division and appeal to members of both Protestant and Catholic and, indeed, non-religious affiliations. So I think it's a more reflection of his and Boyer's approach to theology and religious broadcasting.
The percentage thing only applied to the church services.
Yes, that's right.
He didn't cover the rest of the program.
That's how they allocated the church, and there were 52 over the year, so they had to be scrupulous in the way they allocated that.
John, thanks very much for your presentation. As you know, some historians of Australia argue that before the 60s, secularity essentially meant non-denominational Christianity.
Yes.
And it's only after the 60s that secularity means something non-religious or religiously pluralist or agnostic or whatever. I'm wondering, would you agree with that? And if you do, to what extent do you think the ABC's plain Christianity initiative would have been an important part of that? I'm wondering, was the content something like what Adolf von Harnack said, the fatherhood of God and the brotherhood of man, a classic liberal Protestant content. Could you perhaps tell us a bit more about that? Were Catholic priests also involved in the Plain Christianity initiative? Thanks very much.
My colleague there, who was there at the ABC, might know that better. Were as Catholic priests as well as Protestants involved in those kind of ecumenical programming?
It was largely dependent on their knowledge and on their communication skills.
Mm.
We tried to get people who could communicate, as Henderson wanted to do.
And I take your point about secular taking on a different aspect later on. So that would have included atheism. You're saying more prominently. I just know from my own background, as John said, I grew up in a country town, Cessnock, and it was fiercely sectarian. And my parents in particular, being Protestant, I must say they were off the record. They were very good haters of a lot of things, but the hatred that was most eminent was for Catholics. And I think it's still, it's probably still traces of it hanging on in country areas, possibly less than in the city. And the secularism that you're talking about, that would have included non-religious belief as well, didn't really figure, you know, only it's very marginal and probably took on greater expression on religious broadcasting later on, where there were, there may have been issues of programs related to doubt or dealing with agnosticism, for example.
John,
yes?
Thank you. I was just wondering, was Henderson able to maintain his stance, his approach, without pressure from outsiders, perhaps higher up in the ABC?
I believe so, because he had a very staunch supporter in Boyer, who was the chair. Again, I'll defer to someone who was there at the ABC soon after, but from what I see, I can see he pretty much ran broadcasting up to 1946 into religious content and pretty much got his way, as far as I can see, and formed that thing called the FRAC, which was meant to be a multi-denominational, you know, organisation transcending sectarianism, which is what he wanted, as far as I can see.
Thank you, John. I'm just wondering, was there any anything done in terms of any statistics in terms of how effective the radio has been? And in this, you know, was there any correlation, say, between church attendance and, I know it's an early period, and national church life surveys, I think only came in the 60s, I think, and beyond. Do we know whether it worked in any case? Or
that's a good question. I haven't really seen any research directly into that. I suppose the only correlation is the amount of religious broadcasting on the ABC, which they quantified at 3-point-something% of all broadcasting, and at the same time the religious affiliation stayed pretty constant throughout the 40s and 50s and didn't start to shift until the 60s, I suppose, and church attendance had started to drop perhaps then. And in the period at the time, 40s and 50s, it certainly didn't appear to have an adversarial effect, but that's a good question for further research. I suppose the fact that Henderson stayed on and there wasn't any opposition to what he was doing. As I said, there was some opposition, people saying it was a kind of rather a bland ecumenical theology that was being broadcast, but otherwise it didn't appear to correspond to a decline in church attendance, for example. But that's a good question for further research.
Just one other little quick... was Anglicanism always just grouped with other Protestants, or was it treated separately?
Treated separately.
All the way through from...
Yep.
Okay,
mainly because at the time, from the start, it was the dominant one. And other denominations were much smaller, like what later became gathered into the Uniting Church, you know, Methodist, Presbyterian,
they were
treated separately. They were other.
Who are the
other Protestant.
Thank you.
Just two comments.
Mm?
When I first joined the ABC, community hymn singing was the second most popular program on the ABC after Blue Hills.
Oh, really? Okay. Well, there you go. That might answer the question.
And the other thing was that, this is in the back of my mind, that the Sydney Diocese of the Anglican Church, as a lot of you would know, is probably the most conservative in the world. And so it's an indication that it's not an even playing field across Australia.
Ah, yes. Yeah, that's true.
I was going to ask you about the music, the Catholic, the music on the ABC that was religious.
Yes.
I recall back in, I thought it was in the 50s, but maybe it didn't start till the 60s, Evensong being played.
Yes.
And then there was a program that was called For the God Who Sings that used to be Sunday mornings and then became Sunday afternoon evenings and later, and then it went. And there were other religious musical programs as well that you didn't mention.
Ah, yes, that's true. That's come across in the research. The musical programs were very popular. Yeah.
John, thanks very much. Was there any definition of the word religion from the beginning? I mean, I'm interested particularly in the context of, let's say, the evolution, if you can call it that. Now it's the Department of Religion and Ethics.
Yes.
And, in fact, you get programs that are very fringy religion in any way at all, I would think.
Right.
So, yeah, was there a definition, a clear understanding of what the word religion meant in those first years?
I think it just meant religion and or Catholic. I mean, Protestant and Catholic. It either meant Protestant or Catholic because that's what religion was in Australia at the time, in Christianity. And the others that you say were just grouped together as miscellaneous until much later. I have heard one of the criticisms of the broadcasting about religion on the ABC radio at the moment is that they spent too much time in what you might call the esoteric or the what would have been fringe religious pursuits and the crossover into more like wellness or New Age, a very individualistic, self-centred version of things may have ultimately been derived from Eastern religion or mysticism, but now are far removed from a kind of religious faith. 1960s, as far as I can say. Is that right? To reflect the greater interest in people. You know, that's when people started to get interested in, say, Eastern religion, Indian religion, other forms of religious expression, and gradually the ABC started. I spoke to Rachel Cohen, who did a lot of religious programs, and she started to see a plurality of religious belief in Australia being reflected in the religious broadcasting from, say, the late 60s and the 70s.
Thank you very much. I thoroughly enjoyed it. This religious controversy has been a mystery to me since landing in a non-denominational college, Ambassador College, and it found expression in this almost hatred between the private school Protestants and a very small minority of Catholics.
Mm-hmm.
But my question is outside the time period you've set for your talk, but you said you'd welcome questions beyond, because your book will cover a longer period.
Mm-hmm.
I noticed from the census that there was a spike between 1981 census and the 1991 census, a spike which increased the Catholic presence by 22%.
Mm-hmm.
Now, did the ABC religious broadcast increase by that percentage?
Were they still doing that then? Were they?
I think by then the broadcast of church services was disappearing.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, you know, the allocation of the church services on the based on the census figures, I don't think that was in practice anymore.
Because essentially it knocked the Anglicans off their perch, and I thought
there
might have been, you know, a bit of stirring all around the nation.
Well, I don't know. You may have to ask our colleague who was involved. Was there an active attempt to reflect more Catholic theology in broadcasting, to reflect growing Catholic?
As I say, by the time, what year was that the Catholics? Yeah, look, by then, I wasn't in the ABC by then, I left in 85, but by then the broadcast of church services was pretty well non-existent.
Mm.
And it was only that aspect that was controlled by the percentage of adherence. On the question of the definition of religion, I became director of the department in 1987 or something.
Actually, 1978. In January of that year, Pat Kirkwood became head of religious programs, radio and TV.
My predecessor, James Peter, who was an ordained Presbyterian minister and later Uniting Church, he did, I say unfortunately, try to do a definition of religion, and it was an absolute disaster because it just proved to be totally argumentative. And so when I moved into the department, I was determined never to try to define religion. Mm. The definition that he came with actually was very vague. Mm. It was something to do with really your lifestyle rather than... It certainly right. wasn't churchy. It was right. more to do with people who want to have self-fulfillment, et cetera, et cetera.
I see.
And it caused so much argument that it was terrible.
Right.
I also noticed a 2% increase in the Anglican presence in the 1921 census. I mean, I have no idea why... there was a 2% increase in the Anglicans in the 1921 census, and whether that had any impact, what its cause was. I mean, it seemed a minor thing, but I did notice that on the census figures that you displayed on the...
Well, from what I could see, when they were abiding by those census figures, for the years after each census, they were the governing figures. So if it was from 1921 until whenever the next census was, that would have determined how many services the Anglicans got. And maybe there was an influx of immigration from a certain parts of Britain at the time.
Thanks for your talk.
Mm-hmm.
In 1966, I went to Canamble teaching in a Catholic school. It was brand new Catholic school, high school, and I had a conversation with the local principal of the local state school, and I was horrified to learn... We had 120 children in the whole school, very, very small. Mm. And he said because the Catholic school existed in that small town, the state school was deeply affected because they were, I've forgotten now the terminology, but they were a grade B instead of a grade A school because of the numbers.
Right.
And the 120 kids that we had prevented them from getting so many staff members.
Mm-hmm.
So... I thought we were doing great service to the town.
Mm.
We were actually splitting the town
so
that... And what happened, that school only lasted about 5 years, very short time.
Right.
And we ended up sending a Brigidine nun. I was a Brigidine nun.
Mm.
So a Brigidine nun went and taught in the local state school.
Mm.
So they contributed staff, I think in the 80s, to the local state school, and the local Catholic school closed down. So it's a very interesting question, an interesting example of the development and the change in the Catholic-Protestant split.
Yes, it is. Thank you.
I'd call it difference in Anglicanism between the high church and low church, which is we've seen recent examples of it being very significant. Did that play out at all in those early days? Did the Anglicans have disputes amongst themselves in how they'd be reported on ABC?
That's a good question too. Probably it's the kind of thing that Henderson in his programs, like the wayfaring plain Christianity one, wanted to avoid altogether. And it probably would have been played out in the church services, whether it was the high Anglican service or a low one. I'm not sure at the time in the 1940s and 50s whether the leading Anglican churches were solely high Anglican. It would need someone who was very, very versed in...
not so many.
No, they weren't. So the church services that would have been broadcast wouldn't have been high Anglican.
Mostly middle of the road, average parish.
Right, okay, there you go.
John, that question prompts a deeper question from me. I wonder at times how much of this sectarianism in Australia and elsewhere, we saw it in the 30 Years' War in Europe, we saw it in England at various times, is a post-reformational thing. And there are advantages and disadvantages in being a majority religion. Jeff talked about the divisions in the Anglican Church, and I remember at one point when they came to a head was in the 1920s. So it was between the time that the BBC was founded and the time the ABC was founded. And the Archbishop of Canterbury sought to reform the Book of Common Prayer. And to do that in those days, he required the approval of Parliament, irrespective of whether Parliament was made of atheists or Jews or Catholics or whatever. And the Anglican Church in England, much higher numbers than in Australia, of course, the Anglican Church in England split into three factions, basically the High Church faction, the Low Church, more Protestant faction, who went on a series of what they called Protestant person past pilgrimages all over England, protesting against this change in the Book of Common Prayer. And it provoked somebody in the media in England at that time, and this is the late 1920s, to talk about Protestantism in England being as integral to the nation as salt is to the sea. So this sort of sectarianism can occur within religions as well as between different religions. And it may be that people, as with politics, people are prone to form factions and splits and divisions.
That's true. Yes, I remember I grew up in a very much a Protestant culture, but I remember the Anglican priest who lived next door was vehemently low Anglican, and his greatest fury was for the high Anglican and their use of what he called magic in ritual, which probably was too much of too residual of Catholic. Yeah, that's right. Even the Anglican, so that's quite true.
Thank you all very much.
Thanks.
We've been listening to Professor John Potts, who, among other responsibilities, is Director of the Centre for Media History, Macquarie University, speaking about religion on ABC radio in the 1940s and 50s. The Q&A which followed was moderated by Dr. John Carmody, President of the Australian Catholic Historical Society. It took place on Sunday, the 16th of October, in the crypt of the Parish Church of St. Patrick, Church Hill, Sydney, Australia. ACHS podcasts are recorded and produced by me, John Kenny, on the traditional lands of the Gadigal and Wallumedegal peoples of the Eora Nation. The Society acknowledges the prior ownership, never ceded, of all parts of Australia by its Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. Our speaker in November 2022 is Monsignor Tony Doherty, formerly the Dean of St Mary's Cathedral, Sydney. And he tells the story of St Mary's Spires, the completion of Poulding's programme. We hope that you can join us. Bye for now.